Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm excited about what's coming up right now. We've got a guest coming back to join us again this week, and I'll get into that here in a second. But of course, we cannot bring any other guests on because we don't have our co-host with us yet. And that's why I have to introduce Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. Glad to be here with you guys. We're going on 7 years now. How cool is that? And the thing is, we never run out of stuff to talk about. And thank God for the Facebook group, because that's where we find these great topics and these great guests that come on. So if you want to talk about something, let us know. We got Dr. Joe Holly with us tonight, and we got our meteorologist, Kyle Nelson, but we're going to let him kick back and be a participant and not bother us with the weather. We have our guest back, Michael McGill. We talked to him about some of the challenges of dealing with volunteer search and rescue groups. So, Michael, you want to reiterate just a bit what you do with Miami Search and Rescue?
Yes. So my name is Mike McGill. I'm the incident commander for Florida Search and Rescue. We are a civilian search and rescue organization that just kind of, you know, helps out where we can. And we got our staff is more advanced than the average people, chief of police, firefighters and things like that. So we have a good experience in this line of work. And we basically got together, found out who's got a good skill at the set. And we put it to work. Like I said, we are Florida Search and Rescue, but we just find ourselves all over the coast and where we're needed. We've built up a reputation, and we're just here to help people that need us.
Well, you're certainly in a good place for hurricanes. So let's talk about Hurricane Dorian. So tell us the story of how you guys got involved in that and what you did when you got there.
All right. So, well, like as we were sitting there watching the storm come across, and we watch it develop and get it ready. And then we start going through our, you know, 72-hour, 48-hour, 24-hour protocols that we do to activate our dispatches and alert our teams and, you know, activate our EOCs. And then we notice the storm is going to go ahead and head for the Bahamas. We weren't exactly sure if we were going to get involved at all. We didn't intend on it to be international in that sense. And then sure enough, you know, people started contacting us so that, hey, my friends in the, you know, helped my friends before. I have a friend in the Bahamas that's house is flooded. Can you help? And at that point, we started receiving a pretty good bit of calls. And so we go ahead and decided to do a level one activation on our EOC, and we got our dispatchers up and got our systems running and everything. And we couldn't get them up fast enough. The calls started pouring in across Zillow. Which is a walkie-talkie app that people are using to communicate back and forth during disasters. They were using WhatsApp app. They were contacting us on Facebook, and we started taking these calls. But we're here in Florida. There's not really much we can do for, you know, that place. So we all kind of got our heads together and was like, what can we do? So we reached out and found someone in one of our Zillow channels was part of the government there in the Bahamas and asked us some questions, and we created a relationship with them, and they got us connected with a volunteer firefighter the department in a rural area, the Abaco Islands, and we started pushing tickets out to him, and a ticket is an emergency rescue that goes into our 10-8 dispatching system, and you know, we just hand it like a police department would do or a fire department, and we would hand him the ticket, and he would send his teams out in the middle of the hurricane to rescue these people. And we created such a relationship that they were relying on us to provide them the search and rescue calls, because all their equipment was down, all their radios, and you know, it wasn't for the Zillow being able to communicate, we wouldn't be able to help them. And that's kind of how it started. And then there, it got to the point where we were over inundated with the calls. I mean, we took so many calls. I think we did 384 life-saving calls, during that storm. And it was coordinating with the Coast Guard from America and, you know, the United States, and working with all these different organizations to get these people, because we would get calls from different islands, and we were, you know, trying to figure out what's best and how can we support these people. And it was really a new experience for us to be in a new place, a new area, and learning how to deal with the terrain that we were working with, and that the government was not really there in the sense it would normally be in America.
Yeah, very different animal. You know, that reminds me of a podcast we did a long time ago. I can't even remember which storm it was now, but it shows you how disaster brings out the need and maybe creates some good things. Maybe Jamie can remember what it was. But I had a student many years ago, an EMT student who subsequently became a nurse and was just starting medical school in the Caribbean. And when they realized this big storm was coming in, they had to evacuate everybody. But in the meantime, the medical school was kind of put on task to provide medical care. So these students who were yet to know much of anything past what they already knew became part of a disaster team, kind of an ad hoc thing. And fortunately, when I taught my class, I did a lot of free thinking scenarios so they would think on their feet. And she became one of them and really jumped into it. And from that, the school has decided to create a disaster plan. And it was some years ago. You remember which storm that was, Jamie? That was eons ago. Maybe not.
It was eons ago, and I'm trying to look it up.
Go back. It's in the way back.
I think it was actually... Would it have been Hurricane Irma with Heather Langer?
Yes, Heather.
Yeah,
that was it.
And it was the American University of the Caribbean Medical School in St. Martin Island, and we talked with her, her mother, and what she was doing there. It was a pretty. I remember that call.
Yeah, it was quite a trip. Kyle, any thoughts on this so far? He's the fact finder here. January 9th, 2018. Thank you, Kyle.
That was the data recording. I don't remember the published date. But no, my being a 911 dispatcher myself and thinking about kind of getting this information into to a dispatch system to coordinate that, one of my questions is, because it's one of the things that we have to get first, is the location of the caller. And with, especially in areas like U.S. Virgin Islands and all that in the Bahamas, how did you go about validating or putting these addresses or locations into your system? Were you relying on GPS coordinates or converting things to a coordinate system, or how did you rectify that?
Oh, it was a mess. It's so hard. So trying to put a Bahama address into Google Maps or something like that getting really complicated because they have different state, you know, like you said, we would usually put like Florida would be FL. That was completely different. So we were trying to go off that. When we would talk to people, some of the addresses would pop up and they would, we could populate them in our dispatching. So like as we put them in our software, it'll tell us unfound address, or it'll put a drop a pin on the map and we can see it. So we would take people sending us the GPS coordinates, or they would have to literally, we'd open up Google Maps and walk down the streets. Like, what island are you on? I'm on Grand Bahama, or I'm on Abaco. Okay, what north or south? And they would literally walk us in to an address or walk us down the road. I'm the third house on the left from the corner. And it really took our dispatchers and our operations team to sit down, one on Google Maps, one taking the information and getting it like that. It was pretty tough, because the problem is we had houses where we had water on the third floor. So, you know, we're talking about 30 feet of water, and there is no road at that point, you know, and now you're just where the, you know, counting roofs where you think a road might be.
Oh, God, I can't imagine that challenge. Well, one really good point you made, even though you guys were in Florida, couldn't physically be there, the fact you were farther away when all of their communications resources are disrupted, you were able to pick up some of that. And obviously it worked very well. Joe, your thoughts on this?
Well, you guys are, you know, touching on it. I mean, it excuse me, presents all kinds of unique challenges for sure. And I think even the federal guys heard many of the same kind of issues that we've just been talking about with being able to get access to people and being able to figure out where they were and how to get to them, et cetera. So, I think we all have a very similar experience. It really just comes down to how do we integrate in the larger system when we're dealing with these widespread disasters like this.
Oh, yeah. And it really needed, those poor folks in the Bahamas, everything got disrupted, including the whole healthcare infrastructure. So they needed somebody with a large measure of organization to be able to do this. So thank God for that. Kyle, a question?
Yeah. Michael, I know some of the calls that we take here in our dispatch center, we have a significant population of non-English speakers. Did you run into that during your response? And what resources do you have at your disposal for your dispatchers to be able to communicate with those folks?
So that's a great question. So we manage, for this storm specifically, we manage 64 dispatchers. With those dispatchers, we would break down, different deputy and this. So we had certain calls that would go to certain people. Amy, which, she speaks Spanish. We had other people that spoke Spanish. The language barrier wasn't as bad as it was when we did Hurricane Maria. So those dispatchers played a huge role when we worked that situation. But language barrier was not as big as it normally is.
Well, that's a good question, too. How do you compare Dorian with what happened with Maria?
This was way worse. Just the destruction alone, the shutting down of the systems. With Hurricane Dorian, your government is, Great Britain. They have to send a battleship to you when I got people that can fly there in a helicopter much closer. They lost everything in the sense the government had to basically start all over again and figure it out, like, okay, guys, what do we got here? Where in Hurricane Maria, America was generally on their way. Supplies were starting to flow in, and then we had, we got military bases there and things like that. So it was easier for us to gain control of a situation with professionals that are on the ground. These post commanders and these generals that are already there, they naturally know what to do. And then, you're always with the military, always has a liaison with the government. So it was much easier to coordinate rescue efforts and things like that when it comes. It wasn't easy. And it, by any means, was it easy? But I just think the Puerto Ricans had a better fighting chance than the Bahamians.
Yeah, and they have. In fact, we Jamie and I did a live interview with one of the docs from Puerto Rico, who actually experienced that. He was at a conference with us in Las Vegas. He said he needed a break, so he came to Las Vegas and we interviewed him there. Remember that, Jamie?
I do, and Gustavo has, been on the show several times. He still didn't have power. This was, I don't know how long after the hurricane went through, maybe a couple of weeks, and, his place didn't have power. He told some really chilling stories of, the aftermath and making some difficult medical decisions in that episode. Again, I think the comparison, as Mike said, is apples to oranges, because, Puerto Rico wasn't so far away that the U.S. couldn't get service there quickly, whereas, the Bahamas were really reliant on other resources because, I know for a fact, in Dorian that the U.K. did station some ships in the area because they knew it was hurricane season, but it was still a matter of getting them there. And they were all still limited because of they only had what they brought with them.
Yes, I agree. And I remember when the boat left England or where it left there in the United Kingdom. And I was like, yes, finally. But I'm like, oh, my God. So the heroes of this storm is going to be the American civilians. They without the, you know, Americans having such a great heart when it comes to this debt disaster relief, because we understand it. We know what it's like to struggle during one of these things. And they jumped right in it and started bringing food and water quicker than anybody else. And so, that, you know, in that situation, you know, it was great to see it, you know, their government respond as well as they did, but was really proud to see how Americans did. They really shined out.
That's what we do. So, Joe, what federal resources actually responded to the Bahamas?
There were two federal USAR teams that went there actually under the Department of State, so with USAID, and I believe part of an incident support team as well.
Wow. So, Michael, was our military there as well?
We did not see any military. We saw Homeland Security there was flying in some supplies and, you know, helping out with some medical rescues and things like that. They played a pretty, you know, like the military, but so much as the United States government, they did what they could with what they had. The Coast Guard was, those guys there, I don't know, they didn't sleep for days. They just flew medevacs in and out. And so that's who a lot of times we dealt with. And when it comes to the military, we worked really well with the Prime Minister's office and the Bahama Navy and the local officials there. And there was no issues. Everybody was there, in collaboration and coordination with each other. And it went really well compared to what we've seen in the past.
You know, as an aside here, I have to ask Kyle about this, but I heard that a NOAA weather plane actually got involved in a rescue of a boat that got caught in the storm. I'm not sure it was a fishing boat or what it was, but did you know much about that story?
Well, I'm not familiar with all the details, but yes, one of the planes that are flown by the Hurricane Hunters with NOAA here in the United States did actually assist with a ship that was reported to be in distress. And much like any of us, any mariner, any aviator who was in the area, they began immediately assisting with the search for that crew. And it was really awesome to see that, yes, you know, their primary task and their mission was the science and the observation of that hurricane. But ultimately, you know, even though we're scientists and there's a lot of scientists on that plane, ultimately, it comes down to saving a human life, because you'd expect others to do the same for you. So it was really, really great to see that coming together.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool when I saw the story come through. So, Michael, what were your takeaways from the storm? Like you said, Maria was very different than this was. So what have you added to your arsenal of knowledge that you would change or do differently for the next one?
Something that, you know, when we talk about these storms, we always think search and rescue. That's the first thing we all go to, like, let's do search and recovery. But that only lasts roughly, let's say, 48 hours. The big problem during a hurricane is the logistics. That is, luckily for us, we have gotten really, really good at that at Florida Search and Rescue. We understand that phase one is going to be search and rescue, and then we're going to move right into logistics, because these supplies are about to start pouring in. And where are we going to put them? How are we going to get them to the right people instead of just dropping them in a place? So one of the things that I would like to do in a perfect world, I wish there was a way that we could coordinate supply drops and how supplies are getting to the right places to do the right thing, and reach out to these organizations ahead of time, knowing that they're the same people always going to do the humanitarian relief, and work some type of system out, like, hey, we need that supply at this location, not this location. Could you please transfer it there? So that's one of the things that we always are trying to improve on, understand logistics and get better at it, so the right people are getting the right supplies at the right time.
Yeah, logistics is a whole show in and of itself. People have no concept of how complex it is to have any team in the field. Joe works the IST for the USARs, and I work on the DMAT side, so it's just humongous. Kyle, we're, any final thoughts or questions from you?
No, nothing much from me. Again, another great episode, a lot of great insight. And I'll tell you, this is a great follow-on to the previous episode with Michael and how we might continue to see search and rescue in the emergent and volunteer sense continue to evolve.
Exactly. And every experience is a learning experience. Joe?
Sorry, found that mute button again. No, I'll echo what Kyle said. You know, there's just so many different aspects to this subject in general, and we've touched on, you know, many of them over the years even. But you know, they just continue to be front of mind and remind us that, you know, things like logistics and those sort of things are really, really challenging in these situations, and we're always striving to make those logistics better, to make those operations more efficient, but it's just tough to do that in a chaotic environment of a major disaster.
Which is why you try to refine the processes in between the storms, I would imagine. Michael, you guys are doing fantastic work. Obviously, the need is huge. I'm sure you saved quite a few lives, even from Florida in the Bahamas. I'm quite impressed with the whole thing.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, we totaled some of the rescues out that we did, roughly 386 rescues. So we did a pretty good bit, you know, but we couldn't do it without the Coast Guard, and we couldn't do it without the Bahamian government, the Prime Minister's office. I can't tell you how great those guys were. They were in contact with us by the hour. FEMA did a great job. We talked to them every single day in sit down teleconferences. We were involved. They were involved. And it really took coordinations of all these agencies together to accomplish the same task. And I just want to give a shout out to the Coast Guard. No one ever, you know, they do this all the time, but I was really, really impressed with them. Even as a military person that's been doing this for 17 years, they really showed out this year and they did a great job.
It's interesting because this is the antithesis to the last conversation we had that shows what good work can happen when agencies work together. So that's a refreshing thing. So Jamie, what do you think?
Well, you know, the thing I take away from this, you know, is that how we talk about this all the time, how different every different storm, every different disaster, every different active shooter situation, all of these things have their unique fingerprint that teaches brand new lessons. And it's one of the things I think Joe and the guys at Paragon excel at, which is taking those lessons learned on deployments and bringing them to the training scenarios that they put together so that people get the real experience. People get the most up-to-date and most current information. And, you know, Joe, that's got to be something that you guys, you know, while you're proud of it, it's got to be a challenge for you to keep it all straight and keep updating like that constantly.
No question about it. You know, it's literally a moving target. And the more we do it, the more we learn how little we know. And how much further we have to go to really get it right.
You bring that stuff to people in various levels of training, sizes, and cost structures, and affordability. Where can people reach out to you? Because I think they don't appreciate how customizable this is to specific needs and budgets and things like that. So what's the best way for them to catch up with you?
Yeah, we would love to talk to people. It truly is a very customizable experience, and we want it to be the best for those that are attending. So we would ask that folks reach out to us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at the same name, Paragon Medical Group, or they can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. And Michael, where can people find out more about Florida Search and Rescue?
You can find us on your normal places. Facebook is a great place to catch us. You can find us at FloridaSAR.com. You can find me and the organization on LinkedIn. So we have a pretty good media platform that if whatever's good for you, you can find us on. It'll get you to another one.
And I think you meant FloridaSAR.org, right?
I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I got it right. So yeah, FloridaSAR.org is where you can find Florida Search and Rescue and find out more about that organization. I'm really impressed with them, Michael. So thanks for coming on the show. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Jamie, folks can find me on social media under the handle WXKyleNelson. Feel free to connect with me and follow along to continue the conversation.
Sam, how about you?
I did a Joe there. I forgot the mute button. It's been a long day. Well, you can find me with Kyle in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in our awesome, wonderful 700 people strong Facebook group and disasterpodcast.com. What about you, Jamie?
Well, if people want to catch up with me on social media, they can find me in most places with the handle podmedic at the end of the .com or whatever there. You can also find me on the Facebook group and in our website at disasterpodcast.com, where you can subscribe to the episodes. There's a link right there below the player at the top of each episode page. And I urge you to check that out and subscribe to the show so you don't miss any of our great episodes. We've got some excellent guests coming up soon to actually follow on to a little bit more of this Dorian conversation, disaster structural things. We're going to try to bring Dan Zahner back on to bring one of his experts in and talk about structural capabilities, lessons that they learn from these major events. When you have like a, you know, you can test a structure so far, and then you get to try to figure out how a structure can stand up to 48 hours of, you know, category 5 winds. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in a future episode, so stay tuned. Sam, this has been a great episode, a great follow-on to the previous episode with Mike, and I think you know, it's teaching us a lot about how different types of organizations can work in different situations.
Yes, and how important the training is to do that. So we appreciate people like Michael that step up and take a role where there needs to be one. So I guess we could say for this one that disaster organization is not our everyday organization.